This is the Disability Visibility Podcast with your host, Alice Wong.
Hello, hello. My name is Alice Wong. Today I'm the host of the Disability Visibility Podcast. Talk conversations on disability politics, talk culture, and media. Today's episode is about disability justice, and community organizing with my guest, Sarah Gemma. Sarah is the founder of the newly formed Disability Justice Network of Ontario and co-chair of the Federal New Democratic Party Persons Living with Disabilities Committee. You hear how Sarah became an activist and how disability justice informs her work. Sarah will also talk about some of the major issues facing the disability community in Canada. Please note there will be discussions of eugenics, sexual assault, violence, and institutionalization. Are you ready? Oh, here we go.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
So Sarah, welcome to the podcast today.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you here. Tell me a little bit about yourself, if you want. Tell me a little bit about your background and whatever else you want to share.
Okay. So, I'm from Hamilton, Ontario. Sometimes called the armpit of Ontario, but it's not true. We actually have 72 waterfalls. I think the city is very underrated. I do a lot of disability justice activism and anti-racism activism. I started my organizing in the student movement before moving out into the city. I'm 23. I'm still afraid of the dark. They're just listing off random facts. It kind of depends on what you want to know. Like, I work for the Hamilton Center for Civic Inclusion and for Councillor Matthew Green, who's the first Black city councillor in Hamilton. So he's helpful with regard to learning about racial justice work within systems and outside of them.
Great. And tell me a little bit about Hamilton, because I think when people think of Ontario, they actually think about Toronto.
Yeah. That's true.
But can you tell me a little bit about where Hamilton is in relation to Toronto? Tell me a little bit more about the disability community in Hamilton.
Mm-hmm. So Hamilton is around 40 minutes away from Toronto. It has the highest largest population of people with disabilities in the entire province. We have a fully accessible transit system that's free for people with disabilities. So I think that's part of why we have such a large population of people with disabilities. We also have a pretty adequate mental health sort of community there in terms of service providers. Mm-hmm. In terms of organizing, there's not a lot of community being built between disability justice organizers, mm-hmm. though that's starting to be built up. There are a lot of services in Hamilton for people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. But again, you see like the intersections of like poverty, mm-hmm. hate crimes, and disability. We have some of the largest poverty rates in Ontario, in Hamilton. Mm-hmm. And our city has the second highest hate crime rates, which seeps into rates of violence against people with disabilities. Human trafficking against people with intellectual disabilities is currently being investigated in our city as well. So though we have, like, a lot of positives, there's a lot of work that needs to be done in our city, too. So it just depends on how you look at it. And in terms of Toronto versus Hamilton, our city is currently being gentrified by people who are moving out of Toronto who can't afford to live in Toronto anymore. So people are coming in, and what's happening is you're seeing a lot of people who can't afford to live anywhere else because they're on social assistance and other things, or maybe can't work. Are being pushed out because of the rent prices moving up since people are moving from Toronto. Yeah, these are just some of the issues I can think of on the top of my head.
So with so many people with disabilities in Hamilton, is there any issue with housing? Because I know that, you know, for most cities and towns, you know, people with disabilities really struggle finding affordable and accessible housing. So mm-hmm. with a large population in Hamilton, is that an issue as well? Or?
Yeah, social housing is hard to find when it comes to accessible places. I'm lucky because the place I live in currently is rent to geared income, which is, it's like, it's not market rent. It's based on the income that I'm making. And it's actually the first accessible place that I've ever lived in. It's a building with, like, buttons and bars in the bathroom and things. But throughout childhood, I grew up in community housing in Toronto, and it was never accessible. The bathroom was always on the second floor. And so that's something that you don't really even think about, accessible, affordable housing or social community housing in Hamilton. Yeah, it's not easy to come by.
And, you know, you're a community organizer, and I guess, how did you fall into that, and, like, why do you love being a community organizer, if I may ask?
Okay, so how I kind of got started was, I always tell this story about me being in grade 12. I met a kid in grade 9, his name was George, and he was in a wheelchair, and he told me he wanted to be an actor. And he applied to attend this public, or he wanted to attend this public school called the Etobicoke School of the Arts. But he didn't apply because they didn't have an elevator. And when I heard that story, it was like the first time I had ever, like, thought of oppression against people with disabilities in a sort of systemic way. Up until then, I thought, like, yeah, I had barriers of my own. Teachers called me a liability. One teacher called me a fire hazard. One teacher didn't let me go on a field trip. I had my own barriers, but at the same time, it was always individualized. People with disabilities often think that our struggles are just our struggles and that it's just something that we have to deal with because of the cards that we were dealt, right? But hearing George's story was the first time I ever thought, wow, that's actually really shitty that he's going through this. So I took a bus downtown to delegate in front of the Special Education Advisory Committee in Toronto at the time. And I remember the chair of this committee, I'll still remember his name until today. His name is Chris Bolton. He laughed in my face and he said, "Who do you think you are to come and delegate here, try to delegate? You don't have speaking rights. You're not anybody on this board. If the student wanted to attend the school, he should have applied. How do I know that people with disabilities even want to act?" He started saying all these things and was laughing at me. And I think that was the first time I ever really learned to not internalize the oppressions that I was facing and really see it in a structural way where it was people in positions of power who had the ability to make decisions, choosing not to because they didn't think that the idea of somebody else's quality of life being hindered by barriers to access was a problem. Mm-hmm. And so from that point on, I graduated high school, got accepted to McMaster University, studied school there, and my math class wasn't accessible. So at that point, I got really frustrated, and I decided, okay, I'm going to just run for student council. I had never done anything leadership-oriented in my entire life, but I was angry because it took weeks for my classroom issue to be dealt with because the professor didn't want to change rooms. So I decided, okay, if I'm not going to have any student representatives who are going to try to help, I'll run myself. And I campaigned on a platform of accessibility. And I got elected by the skin of my teeth by my faculty. And within a year, I was able to create the first ever accessibility policy of the student union. And within 2 years, I was able to push for the creation of a service on campus called MAXCESS that was run for students with disabilities, by students with disabilities, that was meant to teach advocacy skills. Not just like the standard accessibility centers run by people without disabilities that are supposed to help you access services. This was supposed to help you figure out, okay, what do we do when the services that are supposed to provide for us fail? Where do we go? What can we actually organize around, or what sort of power do we have as a community of people with disabilities here? And so I think that's how I started organizing and learning about organizing with the disability justice community. And then I became the Ontario Director for the National Educational Association of Disabled Students, and then started to expand my work around intersectionality and do a lot of work around racism and sexual assault and the various issues relating to other communities that also intersect with disability justice.
Mm-hmm. And what would you say are some of the lessons that you've learned from community organizing that do you want to share in terms of like what works, or what are some of the strengths, and you know, what are some of the most important things when organizing around a community and about an issue?
I think one thing that I learned was the importance of coalition building, not just sticking to your one issue or your one cause because you care about it, but the idea that the Indigenous community and their struggles and the struggle for Indigenous sovereignty can intersect with disability justice, can intersect with issues of anti-Black racism and police brutality, or the fact that a lot of the victims of police brutality are people who are racialized, are people with mental health concerns and disabilities. A lot of Indigenous communities who do face struggles around disability and poverty also need that sort of advocacy as well. So coalition building, the idea that we have strength in numbers and that we should be coming together to fight what often is a common enemy of a system that exists, that was created around us, and for us instead of like with us. Mm-hmm. And I think that organizing in silos is exactly what these institutions want us to do, right? Not figuring out a way to organize together, but apart from each other. So that's one lesson. Another lesson is like the lesson of tactics. So one quote I really like is, you can't take down a building without understanding a blueprint of the building first, because if you try to do that without understanding the blueprint, it can fall on top of you. And so the idea of looking at organizing, like building a skill set, understanding and studying when it's important to use a protest as a method, when it's important to use policy work as a method, when it's important to use like your powers in media as a method, or online activism. And understanding that like all these ways of working and organizing are different, and they have different like pros and cons that can be used in various contexts, and not just sticking to like one singular method, but understanding how to organize as a science, right? And building your toolkit that way, I think is very, very important.
And you also, you know, I've noticed a lot of your tweets. You tweet a lot about disability justice. And I learned about disability justice mainly through Susan Fallon and the writings of Bea Vickers when I first really started getting, like, an introduction to what the concept is. So tell me about, I guess, how you understand disability justice and, you know, what you... How would you describe it to somebody who really have never heard of that concept?
Mm-hmm. That's cool. I like learned about it through like reading some of Mia Mengus' stuff too, because she came to campus, and I had no idea who she was. But everybody was like, "You need to like meet this person."
I am a huge fan of Mia Mengus.
Me too. And we got to like eat together. It was really cool. I think what I like about the disability justice framework is it frames disability rights in terms of being intersectional. So talking about things like community-oriented justice and reconciliation, but also like talking about issues around like what I was talking about with regard to race and disability, or the fact that like there's such a huge proportion of people with disabilities facing sexual assault, like looking at the right to exist from a justice framework instead of just like an equality framework and that's it, because oftentimes the disability narrative is... following a white, cisgender man, and that doesn't really apply to everyone, right? That image doesn't speak to equality in my mind. And so, yeah, I think that's why the disability justice framework resonates with me as well. It's more about building community power and community as opposed to just fighting for the rights of a few kinds of disabled people, right? And, like, I think it balances out the fact that even within our own community, certain disabled people are given more speaking rights than others. So you'll very rarely see people fighting for equal representation of people with intellectual disabilities in media or academia. But you'll see, like, often a certain kind of white disabled person in a physical wheelchair fighting for these things, right?
I think the United States, we've had, you know, similar issues where the pervasive, you know, the leadership of most quote-unquote disability rights, you know, established organizations are really thought by women or people of color, much less women of color. So, what does this seem like in Canada? Even though I know it's a huge country, and it's hard to generalize, but would you say, as a disabled woman of color, that Canada is pretty darn white?
Yeah, Canada is also very white in leadership. I think even in the disability justice framework, or disability movement, like whatever you would call it, is still mainly made up of, like, white individuals, though there are a lot more women involved. It's still, like, majority not people of color, black individuals. Mm-hmm. I think, I was making this joke with a friend the other day that, like, I didn't really know that there were other black people with disabilities for a long time. And it's not that they just, it didn't exist, it's just they weren't accessing the same space as I was, right? For various, like, systemic reasons and barriers. But I think, yeah, Canada is also very white in the disability community and who has access to power and speaking rights. And it's often still one kind of disability. Though mental health and mental illness is starting to take up a large, like, space and community, like, regaining that space in the disability justice framework. Though I think there's a lack of understanding in our communities today, especially coming from the outside of the disability community, of the difference between, like, a mental illness and mental health. The fact that we all have mental health, but then that doesn't mean that everybody's technically disabled by it. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of people are now occupying spaces that they wouldn't have occupied before and gaining access to, like, the rhetoric of disability justice without having lived it. But these are all contentious, so I think we could have a longer conversation about...
There might be another episode as well. So you just... We're talking today in early December 2017. Just a few days ago, you were the lead organizer of a really important disability justice conference in Hamilton. So tell me a little bit about the theme and why you organized this conference, and if you could also, you know, tell me the title of the conference as well, and the mission of it.
Cool. So on December 1st, there was a disability justice conference called Momentum, and my friends and I decided to run it because we realized not a lot was happening in Hamilton for International Day of Persons with Disabilities, despite the fact that we have the largest population of people with disabilities in the entire province. So we came together and talked about what we could do, and we decided to run an unconference instead of a conference. So not the sort of suit and tie event where people show up to network, but we actually wanted to Skillshare and build a community. And what we did is we put a call out for proposals for workshops and accepted anything anybody submitted and also covered their transportation fees. So we had people coming from Ottawa to present, Montreal. It was really, really interesting. And some of the topics were around, like, the history of mad justice. We had people talking about struggles in Huronia. So there was an institution set up there for people with disabilities and mental health concerns. And the community there was fighting for to stop a pipeline that was going to go through a mass graveyard that where people were numbered off and buried if you had a disability. And they talked a little bit about that history in Canada that really doesn't normally get talked about. Another presenter talked about the rates of sexual violence against people with disabilities in Canada, because 83% of women with disabilities are likely to be sexually assaulted at least once in our country. So talking about that. And also they talked about, like, sexual health curriculum. We had a bunch of, like, intersecting topics, which is what we wanted to cover. So not taking, like, a one-lens approach, but talking about various modern issues that we're facing in a way that includes everybody in the community. And so what happened was you saw organically people from across the city, but also, like, various provinces coming together to talk about work that they've done and ways to help support each other in the future. So the last part of the conference was, like, a smaller community forum where people could share ideas about what to do next. And actually, the Laidlaw Foundation, which is an organization in Hamilton, announced at our event that they created a pop-up grant that's going to close on January 15th for organizers to apply for $500 just to run an event or something. And it's possible for that to be scaled up if people use up these funds. And these funds are specifically to go toward disability justice activists and organizers.
That's great. You know, a lot of my friends, you know, since we have our current president, there's been a lot of talk to people like, oh, like, disabled Canadians have it so good. And, you know, there's a lot of disabled Canadians who are like, no, we don't. And what do you think are some of the biggest, like, misconceptions that people outside of Canada who are disabled have of Canada in terms of how accepting, accessible, you know, whatever you want to say, inclusive they are of their people with disabilities?
I don't think people in America know the history of eugenics in Canada against people with disabilities. The fact that a large population of people with disabilities in Canada were also forcibly institutionalized. So we had the Orillia Asylum of Idiots, which took thousands of people and children with disabilities, cognitive, developmental, but also even if it was mental illness, and basically locked them away in these institutions. There was a lot of abuse, emotionally, sexually, physically. That we even had, like, the Ross A. Macdonald School of the Blind in Ontario, which was recently the school lost a settlement and had to pay $8 million toward fees for students who were also physically, emotionally, and sexually abused up until, like, early 2000s. So it was very, like, recent. Our history of abuse is very recent. And an $8 million settlement wasn't enough for all the people who had already passed away. It was only enough to cover the people who were still survivors of this institution. I think people also don't realize the amount of hate crimes that people with disabilities face in Canada. The fact that, like, nothing is secure. 75% of women with post-secondary degrees, if you're disabled, are not employed. And that's with a degree, after all the hurdles that you have to face.
And people also think that healthcare is fantastic.
That's true, too.
And while it is, I think, better in some ways, but it's not.
In other ways, it's not. Like, a lot of the funding goes toward children, which is good. Children are cute, right? Who doesn't want to make sure that children with disabilities are not, like, living life to the fullest? But then, as soon as you turn 17, a lot of those, that access to support is cut. So you'll have a hard time finding surgeons to specialize with your disability. I actually said no to the surgery when I was 17 because I wanted to graduate high school on time that I needed. And I still haven't gotten it, and I'm 23, because I just cannot find a surgeon who knows what the hell they're doing, who specializes, right? It's also very hard to find access to other resources like sexual health things or education and things like that. If you're disabled, like, a lot of the funding gets cut. You don't have access to physio and things like that. So it's nice for a time, but it's also not. I think, like, in Canada, there's also the known fact that, like, Down syndrome, for example, more funding goes toward the prenatal screening of Down syndrome than there is toward the quality of life of children with Down syndrome, which means you have, like, doctors pushing people into aborting as soon as they realize that it's a child with Down syndrome or another form of disability. Whether you're pro, like, choice or anti-choice, it's problematic because it's perpetuating a hidden history that no one wants to talk about of eugenics, saying that certain people don't have the right to exist. I think, yeah, there's a lot going on, and I wouldn't go, like, base opinions off of, like, our healthcare system.
And, you know, even though in the United States, you know, we all like to kind of, you know, complain and, you know, talk about the weaknesses and the limitations of the Americans with Disabilities Act, but that is a federal law, and that's something that doesn't exist in, as a counterpart in Canada, but there is an AODA. For people who don't know what AODA stands for, can you tell us what it is and what you think of it?
Yeah, so right now there are three provinces in Canada that have, like, provincial legislation, though we don't have a federal act. Ontario's legislation is called the Accessibility for Insurance with Disabilities Act. And basically the goal of it is to, like, make sure that society is seeing people with disabilities as viable consumers. So making sure that we have access to stores and the ability to move on our purchasing power, right? Because it's, the argument is that it's better for the economy.
Capitalism.
Yeah, which I was going to say. Completely.
Capitalism.
Yeah, it grinds my gears because it basically is saying that, to me, it says that if you can't execute purchasing power, if you're disabled to the extent where you can't work or go to stores, you don't count.
You have no worth.
Yeah, you're worthless. I don't think our focus as a society should be on, like, how much people with disabilities are able to spend or produce. I think we should be talking about real issues like violence, like parenting, like healthcare, like sexual assault, and not just creating legislation around our ability to enter stores. Though it's important, it shouldn't be the end-all be-all of some sort of legislation. And I think my main problem with it is it proclaims that Ontario is going to be accessible by 2025, but the Liberal government, as the Liberal government does, made all these promises without putting funding toward making Ontario accessible. So, as though it's just going to appear accessible.
But eventually by that date, right?
Yeah. So I think that I'm excited to see what 2025 will look like, because when we wake up that morning and not everything is accessible, I think it's going to light a fire under everybody's butts to start organizing.
And you've already been organizing.
Yep. Yep.
So, I guess the last question I'd like to ask is, what do you like to see for the future in terms of your local community in Hamilton, but just also, beyond, in your province and for Canada in terms of people with disabilities?
I want to see people with disabilities being taken seriously as, like, a group of people that are civically engaged, that's going to get up and, like, vote or make, like, brought, like, rocks and boats if things don't go our way. I want to see people delegating in June when the Federal Accessibility Act is finally released and it's not up to par. I want to see people going to Parliament and saying, hey, this is not the way we wanted it to be. And also, they're 2 years late. I want to see people practicing, like, running for office, building power and community power and local power, but also institutional power in a way that doesn't currently exist. And I want to see, like, hopefully more youth involvement in the disability justice movement, because a lot of the people who were responsible for moving it along and sort of creating it in Canada are still alive, which says how new the movement is. And I think there's a lot of room to, like, start mentoring people that are younger in the movement, teaching them about things that have been done in the past and working together to, like, build a future in a way that is, I don't think, is currently being done.
Well, thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you.
For anybody who wants to learn more about you, or how can they find out more about you?
Okay, you can, like, find me on Twitter, @SarahGemma_. And you can find me on Facebook at the same name, Sarah Gemma.
Great. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
Podcast is a production of the Disability Visibility Project. They are an online community dedicated to creating, sharing, and amplifying disability media and culture. All episodes, including text transcripts, are available at disabilityvisibilityproject.com/podcast. You can also find more information about Sarah on our website. The audio producer for this episode is me, Alice Wong. The introduction by Latif McLeod. The music by Wilter Sports Camp. If you liked this episode, subscribe to the Disability Visibility Podcast on iTunes. Support the work of creating disabled media at our Patreon page at patreon.com/DVP. That's patreon.com/DVP. 12 days for listening, and see you on the internet. Bye!